the key now will be to ensure that the momentum isn't lost when the next commission gets up and running, that she delivers on what she said. I was surprised, actually, when she came to our group first one night, and I quizzed her on it when she said it. She mentioned about reducing red tape by 25%. And I said to myself, good God, that's a lot of fucking red tape to get rid of. How is she going to do it?
The complexity of rules which everyone has to farm by has increased substantially over the past 10 years. The EU directives drive most of these rules, but do you really know how these rules are derived and made into law? You are listening to the latest episode of The Tillage Age with me, Michael Hennessy. We would really appreciate it if you could listen, follow, and give us a review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm delighted today to be joined by Sean Kelly, who is a member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, to chat about how EU legislation works and how this affects tillage farmers. Sean, farmers often view the EU with a little bit of suspicion and probably don't really understand how the major policy decisions are made. Can you sketch out how an idea becomes an idea, then gets into policy and eventually becomes law?
Your point is absolutely a very good question, because this applies not just to tillage farmers, it applies to an awful lot of private citizens, businesses and so forth. Firstly, the European Parliament is not like the Dáil. It cannot initiate legislation. Legislation can only be initiated by the Commission. They often do surveys and public consultations before they come forward with a proposal. The proposal then comes to the Parliament. The Parliament says what committee should deal with this. If it's agriculture, to be an agricultural committee. And then each of the groups would appoint what they call a rapporteur, the person who takes charge of the file. They would go through the proposals by the Commission in great detail, and then they would make amendments where they would see there were deficiencies in the proposals. They would have to be negotiated, and eventually they would come to an agreement to put it to a vote at committee level. If it's passed at committee level, then it goes to the full Parliament for a full vote. And the same happens with the member states. The member states, through the council, have to look at it and come to a conclusion. And then when the two conclusions have been arrived, they come together, what they call a trilogue. That's the Parliament's position, the Council's position, and the Commission in the middle. They finally worked out an agreement, and then that goes back to the Parliament in one vote, basically, to accept or reject, and the same in the Council. But 99% of the time, once it reaches that stage, it becomes law, because it's rarely rejected after going through all that process. But it's a good process. It involves a lot of consultation, but it can be complicated, obviously, for those who are not close to it.
Sure. And obviously, Sean, you have and your MEPs have an influence on that somewhere along the line. And I might ask you about where that is. But the other one, I suppose, farmers and maybe the general public are maybe a little bit more suspicious of is the NGOs, where they get in the middle of that kind of process and how they, I suppose, steer it for their own purposes.
Everybody is entitled to make representations. And the NGOs, of course, being basically full-time and being involved in different areas, would be more au fait with what's happening than this, we'll say, a farming organization that has to cover every single angle. And they would be on to MEPs particularly, and they would be pointing out where they would see deficiencies, making recommendations for alterations and amendments. And they could have a lot of influence, particularly if they're big NGOs. And sometimes they have too much influence, and that is something actually we're looking at. And we feel that they have to be far more transparent, and that they have had too much power in many regards. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at, so there's a level playing field, so that all stakeholders can have an equal input and that they have the same reporting requirements. And that is something we are looking at right now. We have made some progress on it, but in the next mandate, that will be further, I think, elaborated on.
Okay. And you, in fairness, from your point of view, you obviously try to have an influence on that as well, based on some of the representations that are made to you, as you rightly said yourself, or some of the contact you've had, I suppose, with constituents here in Ireland. And I've seen you, and I met you at a number of tillage events actually over the last few months. What's your sense in terms of talking to tillage farmers about how the industry is performing in comparison maybe to some of the EU competitors, maybe, I suppose, or colleagues, I suppose, across Europe?
Yeah, I think the Irish tillage sector is a very vibrant sector. It's a very good sector. They're very positive. They work hard and they produce good products. But they do feel under threat at the moment. They feel because we're a small country, and particularly we have more of the vagaries of the weather, which we saw last year, where a lot of crops couldn't be harvested, that sometimes they feel a bit left out in the limb. And also, of course, the fact that dairy farming and probably livestock farming are so big in Ireland that they feel maybe that they are sometimes also not taken as seriously their views as it should be. But I think that's changing. There's more an appreciation now for the good work that the tillage farmers do, the need to have good crops and to utilise them, particularly within the island of Ireland, I think. So I think that the climate is changing somewhat, and the sense of cooperation is developing. But they do, of course, have concerns about the sustainability clauses, maybe the Green Deal, pushing them a bit too quickly, too far, without the supports. For instance, the proposal there, which is now gone, thankfully, that glyphosate should be taken off the market without having anything to replace it. Those kind of things, I think, frighten farmers, understandably so. But I think there's more of a practicality coming to it now, and we must ensure that practicality prevails in the next mandate.
Okay, and I suppose, as you rightly say, you know, the tillage is a relatively small crop in Ireland, but as you look across Europe, tillage is actually one of the biggest areas of production, really. How is, are tillage crops viewed, I suppose, in, amongst the EU legislator? I suppose from the point of view of that, it's obviously it can often be one size fits all, and it doesn't necessarily fit Ireland. If you're looking at France or Holland or Belgium or Denmark or somewhere, that's 50-60% of the land area is tillage. In Ireland, it's only 8%.
That is true. And I see that every week when I travel from Dublin to Brussels, and maybe from Frankfurt to Strasbourg, you'll see the fields there are as big as a farm in Ireland. So it's a far bigger area, right? But at the same time, they have somewhat the same concerns because they're going to have to meet their climate targets. They're concerned about sustainability. They're concerned about reduction in pesticide use. And I think that was one of the reasons why the SOD was probably withdrawn. So, and then, of course, there's a big concern about the input from grain coming in from Ukraine and flooding the market. So they have issues which reverberate in Ireland, but at the same time, it's obviously a far bigger and more stronger component of agriculture in Europe than it would be in Ireland. And for that reason, we need to probably be more cognizant and more supportive of our own native tillage industry.
And I suppose you said it, that there's, you know, there's I suppose, a bit of opposition, and certainly there was very strong protest by farmers over the, you know, the past kind of 3 months, from France all the way across to Europe and a little bit in Ireland here as well. How much, obviously that has influenced politicians a little bit, but how much power do you think farmers have in influencing politicians? And do you think that that might maybe be underestimated by farmers themselves in terms of the power that they actually might hold in their own hands?
To an extent. But what I would say from my experience here, that they should be putting more effort into, if they're protesting, if you want to, or representation more effectively at the initial stages of legislation rather in the final stages. That's one bit of advice I would give to them. Because like you mentioned a while ago there, Michael, the NGOs are in from the start. You don't see the NGOs out in the streets protesting, but they're in at the start looking to influence. And I think that's one area where the farming organisations need to be a little more proactive, and that would make a big difference. Because there is good respect for farmers across Europe. I think the protests themselves were effective in the sense that we saw that the Sustainable Use of Pesticide Directive was withdrawn shortly afterwards. But that is partly due to upcoming elections as well. So you wouldn't want to read too much into that. The timing basically was there. If that proposal was coming 2 or 3 years earlier and it couldn't come because of COVID, it might have been a different reaction. But I do think, though, that farming and tillage was taken for granted for quite a while. It is only after the war in Ukraine, when food security emerged again as an issue, that Ursula von der Leyen and the Commission began to take it more seriously. And also the competitiveness of European industry, including agriculture, came to the fore. But now that is there, and that's not going to go away for the next 5 or 10 years. So we must utilise that to get proper legislation if it's needed, but then proper supports to support the legislation if the legislation involves extra work or extra commitments from the farming sector, tillage included.
Okay, and as you mentioned, Ursula von der Leyen, there is a move, I think, across in the Parliament at the moment to try and reduce the amount of red tape for farmers. Is that, and I suppose there is, and you're probably going to mention it anyway, there's a consultation process, coming back to your point there a second ago, to try and get in at the very start. But do you think that that's to do with an election year this year, that it's more an election kind of thing? Or do you think that there's a genuine view now, or a change of view amongst politicians who are directing the legislator, that it is gone a little bit too far and they do need to pare back all of the rules and regulations that are coming at farmers?
It's a bit of both. I think, firstly, elections obviously had something to do with it, because particularly my group have been very vocal in the past 12 months about standing by farmers. Ursula von der Leyen is from our group. So for the first time in her State of the Union address, she mentioned the importance of agriculture and the need to have a consultative process with them, which she has started, in fairness to her. But also, I think it's because of the fact that the farmers themselves have been affected in getting their message across, that there needs to be more support for them, and that must be taken into consideration. And the key now will be to ensure that the momentum isn't lost when the next commission gets up and running, that she delivers on what she has said. I was surprised, actually, when she came to our group first one night, and I quizzed her on it when she said it. She mentioned about reducing red tape by 25%. And I said to myself, good God, that's a lot of fucking red tape to get rid of. How is she going to do it? So I asked her how she's going to do it, and so she did say that it was mainly to do with administration rather than maybe regulation as such. But she's committed to it, and if she is there the next time, that's the one thing we're going to put her under fierce pressure on from the very beginning: reduce red tape, particularly for the agricultural sector and farmers, by 25%. And it could be done, because you know yourself, there's an awful lot of box ticking, and there's an awful lot of delays because of looking for this and looking for that, which doesn't really have any impact on the productivity of farming. So the message has to be very clear. Farmers must be their farm and not be tied up in red tape.
And I suppose maybe to a point to your old job, but it's everyone would be delighted in terms of you trying to man-mark that one, because anytime the EU have tried to simplify anything in the past, it's never really worked out that way in terms of the end result.
And then you have departments, and our own department would have to take some of the blame as well. They make it worse rather than better.
You mentioned the SUD or the SUR, which failed to progress, through, and failed, I suppose, really all in all. Why do you think that it really did fail? Is it, I know you kind of mentioned a little bit around the protests and maybe there's an election year, but was there a bit more at the heart of that the power of the NGOs, or the power of probably fear-mongering in at the back of it, all this kind of stuff, and maybe some of the targets that were picked out of the air, that it was all seen through in the end, I suppose, maybe? Was it?
I think there are two reasons. One, in some respects, it was convenient to do it as a response to the farmers' protests, because it kind of justified the farmers' protests, and it calmed things down and it stopped them for the moment. But I think there's another issue here which hasn't been highlighted. If you look at the difficulty of getting the Green Deal through, and you see how, for instance, nature restoration law was on a knife edge, you see the difficulties they have with the Industrial Emissions Directive and so forth. The closer we were coming to the elections, the narrower the margin of victory was, let's put it that way. So now, if it came to the Pesticide Directive, even though actually, from an Irish point of view, we had already almost reached the targets, which we should be crowing about, which we aren't. Again, we should be doing that. But I think they said it's better now to take the chance and pull it. because there were two positives in it. Number one, they didn't risk the risk of failure. And number two, it was seen as a response to the farmers' protests.
And do you think, Sean, that the new parliament will come in and it'll be resurrected again and we'll have to go through a similar kind of thing? And if they, a lot of the groundwork is laid, they might get it through the next time, do you think? Or will they have to really seriously look at the science behind what they're trying to do rather than political objectives?
This is the key now, the other point we need to do in the next mandate. Before any proposals are introduced to ban something, there must be an assessment done, proper assessment, how it's going to impact productivity and farmers' profitability. And there must be an alternative to ensure that production and profitability are reduced. I think if those two things are done, then they can progress along the lines they're going, because, okay, you do need, ideally, less pesticides, you have to promote more pollinators and so forth. But there was a kind of a mad rush to get it all done, and now it's time to put on the brake, do properly, bring the stakeholders with you, and ensure that it's done in a sensible, progressive manner. And I think you'll be able to get that done. And the fact that you allow for 5 years again, if it comes in early, should be enough time to ensure it. But the key here, and this is what the farmers have to do, is, okay, you want in something, is there an alternative that's less damaging to the environment? If you're saying this, what we're using at the moment is damaging. And I think that would appease a lot of the concern out there. But otherwise, just taking something off the market and having nothing to replace it, and then having weeds growing, you can't do anything about it, that's not going to work.
I suppose there's other serious problems, Sean, coming up along the line, such as there's a new variant of blight in potatoes, for instance, which is affecting and will affect a huge amount of potato crops in the country next year, which the existing chemistry that's there is not going to be effective because nature changes, essentially, and can get over it. And I suppose just in terms of the parallel things you're talking about there, do you think that there will be a recognition that nature is probably going to run faster than politicians, in the sense of we need more innovation and we need to try and look at some of these products that are coming to the market and try and get them through it a little bit quicker than is happening today?
That's exactly it. And I think there's precedent for that in the manner we were able to get immunization for COVID. That emerged in massive quick time, in fairness now, but it was all about cooperation. So we have the brains, we have the research areas, just a question of collaborating, giving them priorities, putting the resources behind them to innovate. And that's really what we need to do. And if there'll always be new variants emerging, to be able to have products that will deal with them pretty quickly. And I think that's well within our compass because of the Horizon Europe program we have, a massive 100 billion plus research project, which can really get the best scientists together and get them to deal with these issues and be ahead of the game rather than trying to chase it from behind.
You mentioned earlier, Sean, around farmers and farmer influence. In terms of Irish tillage farmers, how or is there one or two or three things that you can think of there that would that they can best do to try and influence some of the policy decisions that are coming through Europe?
I tell you, on the 25th of March, from tonight, I have a public meeting in the Horse and Jockey, and it's about putting carbon farming in the hands of farmers. Farmers, tillage farmers, are storing a lot of carbon, for which they're getting no credit whatsoever for at the moment. And I have been working on a proposal here by which a framework would be established to assess that, and then they'd be able to utilise it and monetize it. Basically, you'll be putting those who are storing carbon in touch with those who can store carbon. And I've met a few intermediaries who are now developing that. So I think that's an example of where we can make a lot of progress. We are doing a lot of work on it. And I think in that night in the Horse and Jockey, you will see where we have been in touch on a regular basis with the commission on it. They're very keen on what we're doing. And I think together with yourselves in Tagusk, with the department, we can get a monetization system in place to make the most of the carbon we are storing. And a lot of it is being stored, but we can't quantify it yet. Once it's quantified, and then you can utilize it from there on.
And where do you think that that's going to go, Sean, in terms of a farmer income? It's kind of nice to know it all, but I suppose to date, farmers have struggled, and industry that we talk to struggle to say, well, we'd like you to have all these sustainability bits, including carbon in the soil, but we're not really prepared to pay you for it. Nobody really is. We can't really seem to be able to get that from the market. Where do you think the payment's going to come from?
Payment will come, and they're looking for it already. Companies and industries who can't meet net zero themselves. And I've been in touch with them, and they've been in touch with me. Big international companies, particularly companies, aviation companies, steel companies, glass companies, aluminium companies, they're all waiting for a carbon market. And once we have the verification in place, then we'll be able to utilize that market. And I can see that happening sooner rather than later, because it has to happen, and it's a benefit to both.
And not to get into the technicality of it too much, but it does strike me as you're talking about, you know, those industries that you mentioned, all of which are probably outside of Ireland, Ireland in general, and agriculture has its part to play in reducing the carbon, greenhouse gases from Ireland in general. If a farmer sells the carbon that's being captured, and that goes to a British Airways or Qantas or a big steel company in wherever, is that lost to Ireland, or is that, how does that work? Is it a fear that we're kind of selling our assets to somebody foreign?
That's something that has to be worked out. But I don't think so, because the farmer will be getting paid for the carbon he's producing. So in that sense, you have a global target to reduce emissions. So I couldn't see how it would be seen as affecting Ireland per se. But of course, you also have aviation companies in Ireland who would be possibly first in the line to do it. And you have other companies in Ireland who would also be first in the line. So you mightn't have to sell it abroad at all, especially if Ireland wasn't getting credit for it. But I think on a European-wide basis, that will be worked out satisfactorily, because it won't be possible to sell all the carbon or produce all the carbon in one particular country and keep it there and get credit for it. So there'll have to be a kind of a single market, I would imagine, for it.
Oh, very much important. Last question, Sean, because I know you're busy, very busy, and thanks very much for coming on. But in terms of the overall landscape that you're looking at in terms of the potential for agriculture, are there a number of things which are exciting, or you think Irish farmers should be excited about, maybe specifically the tillage sector should be excited about, that's, you know, legislation is coming through which is going to enable, you know, something new or exciting to happen?
I think what should be exciting to happen, there should be more cooperation between the tillage sector, the dairy sector, and the livestock sector, with contracts in place. And also, I think, where grain is concerned, we will have to get an agreement of a minimum price for grain. And if you have issues for one thing or another, that the price cost goes below that, there should be automatic compensation. Secondly, if you have issues where, like where this year, the grain couldn't be stored, there'd be or couldn't be harvested, there should be automatic compensation to bring you up to the very minimum, which is seen as keeping you above water. I think that needs to happen rather than waiting, as we saw this year and the same a few years ago, I remember, for the worst to happen. And then the farmers have to organise themselves, and the teenage farmers hold meetings, and then eventually the government might put forward a scheme, and the scheme might take 6 months, and the scheme won't be good enough, and there'll be red tape put in its place, and we won't be able to get it because something didn't happen in a particular date. I think we need to get over that. so that there is genuine support there and that you know it in advance, so that the farmer can say, at least I'm not going to go broke any particular year. There's a minimum by which I'm going to get. That's going to cover my costs. And then in good years, I'll make a profit and maybe a good profit. I think things like that, that security has to be built into it, which isn't there at the moment.
And is that true crop insurance, do you think, Sean? Or what sort of mechanism would you like to see?
I would say to insurance is one area, because they do that very effectively in the United States. But also, I think it could be certainly part of the next CAP, where we would look at that whole area of security, not just of supply, but also security of profitability for farmers. And I think that's something that needs to be examined a little bit more. And possibly also, which we have never done, probably indexing the payments, because we saw them being eroded hugely due to inflation the last number of years. So there are areas we can learn from the past. And I think the bottom line is that we, in Ireland, of course, we're talking about growing the tillage area. That's another thing we need to have a little bigger conversation on. How is it going to be done? Where is it going to happen? What is it supposed to make it there? So we have a lot of things to discuss to put the plans that are there into practice. And I would hope that we could see that coming into effect as soon as the next commission and possibly the next parliament and possibly indeed the next government in Ireland, which mightn't be that far away either.
Okay. Well, listen, Sean, I really appreciate your time. I'm delighted you could join us. And certainly on that positive note, I think everyone's going to be delighted to hear some of the plans and the way you were thinking, certainly about that, because, it's going to be a very difficult year, I think, for Irish farmers this year, because not only a really bad harvest last year, but really, really bad weather since then, as you know yourself, when you're coming and going. But listen, thanks very much, and best of luck with the election later on in the year.
That's very important. Hopefully we'll cross the line. Thank you very much, Michael.
So that's it for the podcast, and my sincere thanks to Sean for joining me on the show. If you enjoyed the podcast, then recommend it to a friend or colleague, and as always, rate, review, and follow on Apple or Spotify so you never miss an episode. And for more information, go to chagas.ie. I'm Michael Hennessy. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with more tillage news and advice.